Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
So I was thinking what I would say when you say how are you, because everybody says that, how are you doing? It turned out I avoided the question, but which is one alternative, and then the other alternative is lying, as in just saying fine, whatever, even if it's true, it's kind of a lie, because you're just throwing it out there as an automatic response. And then the third alternative, of course, is answering the question honestly. And then I was thinking about, you know, those times in life where you, I'm sure you do, I'm assuming you will, where you don't know if you're on the verge of a breakdown or a breakthrough. Yeah?
All right.
So that's how I'm doing. Anyway, just to get the pleasantries out of the way.
Well, then let's be blunt here and say I'm in an incredibly similar place. I actually joked. It's really funny. I joked. I was talking to Misty Greer a few weeks ago, or a week or two ago. I don't know. And I was talking to her. I didn't know. I don't know if you had just contacted me or you contacted me a few days after I said this. But I've been feeling a strange sort of, like, really tense kind of mental state. And I said, Horsley always contacts me when I'm in these states. I don't hear from you for, like, months at a time. And then, like, suddenly my world's falling to shit and I get an email from you. And I'm like, right. This guy is, like, got crazy radar.
Yeah.
So we can,
Sure, we can talk around that or into that. Yeah, great. I mean, that's... Yeah, it makes perfect sense. It's not necessarily the case that I'm in that state, unless I pretty much always am, which it does sometimes feel like that, but that can't be true, because I wouldn't have brought it up today if it wasn't particularly the case now. So yeah, but in general, I prefer interacting with people who are in that very raw, vulnerable, open state of change for, I would think, obvious reasons, but perhaps not obvious to everyone. I guess when the constructed identity is less solid, less stable, and there's chinks in the armor, then there's more stuff coming through. And it's the flip side is, because if one's feeling that vulnerable, then one wants actually not to feel that way. So one goes into the head in order not to, so that's always going to be a temptation, and it's one of the things I am aware of doing the podcast pretty much every time. It's like that there's always that line of least resistance where you just go into the intellect and the mind and talk about ideas, but on the other hand, talking about personal stuff isn't that productive either. That doesn't actually make it more intimate necessarily, talking about our personal lives, right?
So you sent me this article, which I did read just before we got on the call.
The Death Day one?
I read both. I read the Guardian article, and then I read the one that was...
I'll call it Yorkshire.
Yes, absolutely. You know, obviously, or I don't know if it's obvious, but the British world of celebrity and sort of names, a lot of that goes straight over my head. Like, I know...
Not Jimmy Savile, I presume.
Well, to a certain extent, yes. I mean, I only know of him... in the last few years from quasi conspiracy. So, like, the people who were pushing to out this man who was a household name, but he wasn't a household name in my household.
Sure,
So
yeah.
I hadn't heard of him before, the last few years. But as an old, '60s rock fan, I probably should know that who that is.
Well, I don't know about should, but he's an enormously culturally significant figure, and more so than I suspected. Obviously, I hadn't thought about him in 20, 30 years until, except the occasional mention by David Icke or someone like that. I guess I was aware that he was part of the networks of abuse before it became public knowledge. I guess I was, but I couldn't even say for sure about that, because it went from just a blip on the radar to, like the whole alien invasion kind of thing with Savile. And for me, Savile was, as it was actually, my wife was into him for months and months, not into him, that's an unfortunate choice of words, but she was looking into and fascinated by everything that was coming out for months and months, and she kept pointing me to it, and I kept resisting. I kept, like, saying, "This is not interesting to me. Why do you keep bringing it up?" And then finally, I wouldn't say I got it, because it wasn't an intellectual thing, but finally I lined up. I think it was after Crucial Fictions, and I'd done the Strieber work, and I'd began to see the social engineering, the real implications of that, and how it affected me. And maybe seen or not seen, I was looking into movies and pop culture. At some point, the Savile thing really fell into in line, or clicked in place with everything else I was doing, and then it became like the game changer that my wife had kept saying it was. I said, "Okay, yeah, this is actually a crowbar that's actually leveling open the whole thing in a certain way if it's used right." And even just at a kind of superficial level, it's like, it's certainly, if you're in Britain, you just say, "What about Jimmy Savile?" People can't talk about conspiracy theories in the same way as in, it's just rumor, it's just myth, because you just say, "What about Jimmy Savile?" Right? It's just there now. So that's in a more general way, but specifically for me, it
Can
became more and more relevant because of the connection to
I
my
ask you a
family, I
question
think.
about that point that you just made? I just want to sort of go into that a minute because all right, I remember I've said this many times, but I remember growing up and people talking about the JFK assassination. I sort of had this fascination with it as a child, not like the details of who did it, but the JFK assassination intrigued me as a child because everyone talked about it as if they knew there was a conspiracy. But you'd never, like, it never sort of crossed the finish line, if you will. It sort of like got so fucking close. So everyone would be like, "Oh yeah, well, And but nothing was there. And I was always like, "But wait, you're telling me everyone knows that there was a conspiracy, and like nothing happened? There was no justice, no ramifications, no anything. Like it just." You all just went about your lives? Like, it didn't make sense to me as a child. And then I remember, like, a similar sort of thing of being like, I grew up Catholic. The sort of the child molesting priest. It was like an archetype. It was like a joke. Depending if the person was religious, they'd get really defensive. But it was a sort of like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Everyone knows. And it never crossed the finish line until I don't know, in the last maybe 6 years or so. I'm bad with dates, but there came a point where, boom, breaking news, this thing that everyone's known about forever, we're finally going to address that now, is that a, like, what do you make of these types of things? Like, when you say, like, the thing that you could, I could say, I have such mixed feelings about it, but I liked how you said, at least it gives you that sort of point to say, well, can you deny that anymore? Like, is it a breakthrough of some sort of truth?
I guess there's different levels to that because, even if it is that really a breakthrough, right? Even if it's a breakthrough at a social level, and I'd say yes, beyond doubt, the Yamiseval thing is, it's not comparable to the JFK thing, to the extent that, as you say, in the JFK thing was never officially acknowledged. There was never an official confirmation, like with the UFO, that yes, this is a cover-up, or yes, this is a conspiracy. Whereas with Saville, it actually, well, it didn't exactly begin as official story because there were David Icke and there were rumors, but there wasn't a big conspiracy theory around Jimmy Savile. It pretty much began with the official news about this guy is not what we thought he was, and he was a sex abuser of children, and it kept growing. The crimes he committed, more and more people were coming forward, and it got sicker and deeper, but also at the same time, the affiliations and the implications. So the Royal Family and the MI5 and the countless police cover-ups and the paedophile information exchange and the networks. So it was different in that regard too, because it wasn't just around one man or one event. It was that what was coming out about this one man and his deeds implicated the whole
Right.
British institution, the BBC also is one I didn't mention in that. So at a social level, absolutely, it is a breakthrough of truth, small t, historical truth, whatever the fuck that is,
Right.
So the people have been abused and people are speaking up about it. That's significant. So, and I guess that's what's more significant to me. Because I said it's impossible, I think, to really know, like, whether a social revelation of crimes, particularly, even if they are prosecuted, but in this case, the guy was dead, right? So, the only thing that's happening in Britain around actual kind of social justice is that many of the victims are being compensated, or at least asking for compensation, and because there's hundreds of thousands of them, that could actually threaten the British economy if it was allowed to proceed. So that's socially significant. But what's more interesting to me is that because it suggests that sexual abuse of children was massively widespread in Britain, was and is, we're talking about countless people, including people who actually grew up, with Jimmy Savile, watching Jimmy Savile on TV, like myself, part of that culture, but today, who have been sexually abused as children and who don't know it, essentially, who don't remember it. Okay, and this, when I say it out loud, it sounds like it's an inference or an assumption, but and maybe it is, but it certainly seems to be true in my case and other people I know personally. So then, that really is that. That's a massive destabilizing factor in terms of the truth coming, breaking through, and the kind of change that it can have at a social level. For what it's worth, I don't think that necessarily will have good consequences at a social level. I don't really believe in good outcomes at social level. I don't know. I just don't think that that is ever really a result of
No.
these things.
Right. It's
You
not the
feel that
desired
way?
goal. And so, as I said, as a child, I thought, well, what, why wasn't as some why wasn't something done or whatever? But I've come to realize nothing ever gets done. I mean, you can, and what is there, and in a fucked up way, what is there to do? So is a financial settlement. Like you said, so you're mentioning the financial aspect, right? The legal aspect. Like we had a Martin Luther King in that assassination, there was an official settlement where they said, "Oh yes, the U.S. government was complicit in the assassination of Martin Luther King." It went through in the courts. The family got a financial settlement, And
oh, I missed that.
Done.
That's interesting. So they actually confirmed the conspiracy theory about Martin Luther King.
Right. Well, at least the court system did. Yes.
Yeah.
So you know, there's criminal court and civil court, right? So it's like O.J. Simpson. He's innocent of killing. He's found innocent. He didn't kill his wife in criminal court, but they win in civil court and they get financial reward or restitution or whatever phrasing you want to use.
So that's like a buy-off.
It's like a buy-off, exactly. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it's like with this weird, like, all right, fine, yeah, here, have some money. And it's like, is that a goal? And at the same time, even the justice system, if someone goes to jail, you know, if what is that? What is this? What is the goal? I struggle with that.
Yeah, well, if people go to jail, I think Rolf Harris went to jail, and he was even more of a kid's entertainer than Savile. That creates the impression that something's being done, of course, but the people sending the perpetrators to jail are also perpetrators.
Precisely.
So what does that mean? It's PR.
Right, and when it's institutionalized in such a way, it's just like, you know, corporate insider trading. They pick one or two schmucks and send them to jail or fine them, and then, like, well, we've taken care of that, you know, but there's 1,000 other guys who used essentially human shields, throw some meat to the wolves when the mob is interested. Oh, someone's got to pay for this abuse. All right, we'll throw these two guys in jail and move on with our lives. You know, the hunger will be satiated. That's the scary thing to me on the social level. I don't exactly know. I'm constantly having conversations with people like, what are the... I don't have an answer for this, but like, you know, it's, again, here in the States, we're in such a racially polarized moment, right? This is the topic of the moment here in the States. And, you know, I still sort of hear people say things like, well, we've had a black president, you know, what is... that mean? Is that culturally significant? And to me, I'm sort of like, again, as a white man, so maybe I bring my own bias to the table, but I'm like, well, if he's a psychopath, just like all the other presidents we've had, what the fuck does it matter what color his skin is, right? And at the same time, I'm constantly being told, well, if you were a person of that color, it would have another meaning to you. You know, someone said to me...
Wait, are you being told that by white people?
Both. The example I was just about to give is from a white man. I have a friend who... his wife is pregnant. She's about ready to give birth. And he said, my daughter will grow up in a world where that's already happened, you know, and he saw that as like just the sort of time period of, and it's true. Like I look at my wife has younger sisters. They grew up in a world where the internet was already a thing, where everyone has a phone. So their experiences, they're culturally time-stamped, as you and I are, right? Anything that you can bring to the table is going to be based on your experiences, but also as you're writing in your article, how are you shaped and molded by the forces and influences around you? You say children emulate what they're shown, not what they're told. So in this way, you know... if you grew up in the 60s and 70s, me growing up in the 80s and 90s, we have different but somewhat similar experiences because maybe there was a longer stretch of sort of like that jumping. I don't know if this expression means anything to you. You're familiar with like Jumping Jesus. It was a Robert Anton Wilson sort of expression for like the rapid acceleration of and condensation of technology, but not just technology, but information. So the acceleration of things. Whether or not that's a true, that's just something we're perceiving or placing too much importance on. Again, I see these, my wife's younger sisters, when I see, they have no sense of what life was like before everyone had these devices. To them, it is totally second nature. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I think in many ways it's a, and I'm not also, well, it's not saying it's a bad thing. It's
You
just,
can't,
it's their
no.
cultural time thing. It's the world they're born into. And so anyway, my friend's statement was his daughter will be born into a world where there has been a black president. And again, while that is a almost a trite platitude from my standpoint, my cultural standpoint of like, it doesn't matter, they're all fucking sick, psychopathic assholes. I'm trying to get outside my own.
Well, because he is saying, to take up your point or your feeling, he's saying they've grown up in a world where a black man can also be a psychopathic, controlling, ruling elite, puppet dictator, whatever the correct parapolitical, analysis would be of Obama. And I don't suppose you or I are qualified to really say exactly what Obama
For
is,
sure.
but he's only half black anyway, so it doesn't really make sense to call him a black man, because if you called him a white man, you'd be looked at like you're crazy. But it's 50-50, so I think there is some, even though that might seem like a trivial point, I think
It's
it's
a totally
not.
a valid point, and I think also, but it also goes to American history. What was wasn't it? You could, if you were at least one eighth black, you were considered black as far as slavery laws were concerned. So I mean, there is a sort of cultural, historical significance to, 50% is good enough for America. If you got a It's so fucked up. I see your
It's
facial.
all
Yeah, it's
fucked up,
so
yeah.
fucked up. Come on, the whole thing is a mess.
Many a hand has scaled the grand old face of the plateau. Some belong to strangers, some to folks you know. Holy ghosts and talk show hosts are planted in the sand to beautify the foothills, shake the many hands. There's nothing on the top but a bucket and a mop. Illustrated book about birds. See a lot up there, but don't be scared. Who needs action when you got words? With the mop, then you can stop. Look at what you've done. The plateau's clean, no dirt to be seen, and the work that it took was fun. There's nothing on the top but a bucket and a mop and an illustrated book about birds. See a lot up there, but don't be scared. Who needs action when you got words? The many hands began to scan round for the next plateau. Some said it was Greenland, some said folks you know, and whatever. Others decided it was nowhere except for where they stood, and those were guesses.
So, I mean, I think this does touch fairly close to my own feeling of being in a bit of an emotional quandary right now, and in terms of ideology now. Okay, the deeper reasons for how raw I'm feeling have to do with what we were touching on with, sexual abuse, of course. I say of course, but maybe to you it'll be obvious you read the piece, right? But in lieu of going there, because that's obviously a big commitment to go into that area, there's definitely something that's stressing me now around ideology. And okay, so I'll tie this question of ideology with something you said, and while you were talking for a while there, you said that anything I bring to the table is going to be dependent on, I'm paraphrasing now, you know, my cultural conditioning. Okay, and so this is, I mean, I would refute that. I'd say that it is possible for each of us, you or I, to bring something up from the deepest part of ourselves which is unencultured, which is undistorted by cultural conditioning, uninformed by it. It is possible. Not easy, but that's back to that space that we want to create where neither of us is directing it, because what directs us is our cultural conditioning most of the time, right? If we're just at a mental level. So first of all, that, what is it in us that can express itself, can come into form and expression that isn't influenced by our cultural conditioning, you know, the authentic expression of the total psyche. That juxtaposed with ideology, which is enculturation, and how I think it's undeniable that ideology is becoming more and more insidiously embedded in the human psyche, or whatever you want to call it, in us as beings, to the point that, well, we could go into any number of examples, but the example that you've just brought up, that this person you know states that his children or whoever have grown up with a black president, as if ipso facto that's a good thing, as if that signifies progress.
Well,
that's an ideological
position. To be fair, I don't want to speak for him, so I don't know that it's... I don't know that it's fair to say as if it's a good thing. Okay, so clearly from his point, he saw that as a good thing, is that, yes, his children will grow up in a world where at least there is an additional possibility on the table. You and I are both pessimistic enough to say... Yeah, but they're growing up in a world where, paramilitary propaganda is on every channel on their television, not even hiding. It's in plain sight, you know, where we have a question, you know, the debate is limited to should we drone bomb 10 countries or just 9, you know. I'm a pessimist or realist or whatever. Like, I see a pretty bleak future if I were to have... I'll be honest, I'm terrified by the idea of having children because of that future. Not because of a black president, but because the future looks pretty fucking bleak to me, if I'm being blunt.
Isn't it here? I mean, not to split hairs, but the present looks pretty bleak.
And... it's hard because you titled, what did you title our last time I was on your show? You called it like something about hope, a vague sense of heaven or something. It was like struggling to find a hope. And I'll be honest, man, it's like I'm constantly doing that, like trying to find a silver lining. And it's almost like just to make it through the fucking day. Like, what, you know? Otherwise, what's the fucking point, right? Do we just keep marching into the swamp of sadness, or do we try and...
Okay, so let's stay on that thing now. And otherwise, what's the point? So if you can't find a hope and a purpose in the day, then what's the point? Isn't that a sort of circular question? Because you're essentially saying, if I can't find a purpose, then what's my purpose? Which is a good question, but it's more, you know?
Totally.
Like the part of you that said, what's the point, is an emotional thing of like, I want to give up. I just want to fucking give up and die if I can't actually find reason and meaning and purpose. And I feel like that every day. I was just saying that to my wife. She doesn't like me mentioning it on podcasts, but I keep doing it. that every morning now, and it's not just in the morning, but it's most acute in the morning, I wake up and I'm like, what now? I've got to get up and there's nothing. I mean, I don't have a fucking job. So, and I'm not complaining, but I mean, if you have a job, then that just sort of takes over your schedule and all the rest of it. So, I am blessed with so far, enough savings and a few measly donations, hint, hint, to more or less make me feel secure enough to just keep doing the things that I'm doing creatively now. But they're very, because I'm my own boss, I determine where I put my energy and time, and many people think that that's a real blessing and it's what they want. But the flip side of it is, or part of it is anyway, my experience is this waking up in the morning and feeling like the day is completely empty because I do not have a sense of, a consistent sense of purpose, like that, like my identity, what's left of it, is not hardwired to some sort of mental idea of purpose. I just don't know what it is, because there isn't one. There just isn't, and it's not about how fucked up the world is. This is existential. It's like the whole universe is going to fold into nothingness at some point, kind of thing. Like Woody Allen, not to quote him, but anyway. So, but then what happens is that I get up and then I go online. At the moment, it's a lot of this forum, Rigorous Intuition, and the stuff going on, and I get. You could say I get sucked into, chronivores, but I don't experience it
Oh, I
that
love
way.
that expression, chronovores.
It's a great one, eh?
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, no, I don't experience it that way. Generally, I experience it as my attention gets engaged by something meaningful. It's interaction with human beings. We're working on a mystery. We're working on, the thing, the drill, like in integrating the trauma and becoming more embodied, and it's happening. It is happening on a daily basis, but at a mind level, I'm getting it less and less and less and less. That's the breakdown. That's a breakthrough, I think.
Well, it's funny because All right, so my financial situation is different, in the sense that, like, I have to go to work, and that's, in one respect, I do understand the idea of, like, well, it's a thing to do. It's like it's a quote unquote reason to get out of bed. It's like I want to just lay in bed and be like, I hate everything, and like, well, I have to get up and go to work. I don't have a choice, right? I don't have a choice, You gotta do what you gotta do, It's that's just as powerful philosophical position as anything Sartre ever said. So the idea that you just fucking do it. You go and you force your way into it. But then I realized that there's the other, like, sort of aspiration of reaching the point that I won't have to do that, right? Like, I can give myself this weird goal of, like, well, one day I'll reach the point where, my website brings in enough money, or I don't know what. I don't know what where the money would come, or whatever. I won't have to
Right,
do this
the
anymore,
hope.
right? And I could just pursue this artistic pursuit.
Right.
But then there are moments where I'm like, is that empty? Like, like reading the article where you're talking about the society that values the quote unquote art, does it usually at the expense of someone's soul? And I see as I'm pouring, like, and let me be clear. In moments of inspiration, like when I'm working on something artistically, that I do get genuinely excited, and it's a genuinely joyous thing for me, and I don't say that for anybody's ears other than just, like, stating a factual truth. Like, there are days where I'm like, oh my God, this is, I'm so excited, like, like running, racing home from work because I got this idea I want to fucking work on tonight or whatever. It happens, but then I make the thing, and I'm like, this is fucking great. And then 2 days later, I'm like, so what did I do? Did I change something? Did I, what? I don't see the sort of nagging doubt comes knocking back at the door and says, well, what the fuck did you really do? Again, it was essentially a masturbatory experience of like, I'm so excited about this thing I'm making, and I'm like, and then what? And then what?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, what?
Well, that's a good parallel, because it's got sublimation and creativity to a large extent. Depends on sublimating the libido. And we're not just procreative animals anymore, if we ever were just that. Who knows, right? But I'm certainly not. I mean, there's no way I'm going to have a kid now, barring some kind of weird intervention. So that's not even a thing. And a great deal of that kind of creative urge goes into doing stuff and, yeah, expecting something to happen as a result of it, expecting to give birth to something. And that, I mean, the thing I didn't mention in my sort of weird daily headspace is that what keeps me going through the day, paradoxically or perversely, is the idea of something that's going to happen, the idea of something in the future, you know, in that day.
Yeah.
I mean, also what you're saying, that there'll be the email or there'll be the whatever that will suddenly change everything in a larger sense, but even just in a mundane sense, like, what do I have to look forward to today? Like yesterday, I realized, well, I was talking to you that I was going to look forward to. And that's a kind of slight sea change, because it's being more honest that actually the things that satisfy me are connecting to other sentient beings. And it's pretty much it, Alan. The other stuff is becoming less and less meaningful to me. And there is a feeling of being more and more bereft, because in those spaces where I'm not connecting to somebody, all I have is my own inner space, which, of course, is everything we are told and we believe, and some part of us knows. I mean, that is, you know, well, I don't even want to slap a platitude on it, but that's us, right? We are the perceptual mode of existence, the only one we'll ever know. So that's the treasure is right there within, but to access it is so hard. So then, yeah, when I'm connecting to others, I feel like I'm able to access it by responding. Right? Or responding to the other. But then when it's just me in the space, then it's like, well, what is it? Next TV show, next food, next, you know, stimulus, next sexual interaction, if I'm really optimistic. You know, and that, like you're saying about the creative pursuits, and this includes the creative pursuits, it doesn't really pay off. I see it more and more as a sort of pacifier, which I don't think is a bad thing, because I think if we're in integration process or individuation process, then we need pacifying, we really do, because it's a horrible crisis. And the other thing I was going to say to you, if you asked how I was that individuation is the, this is Jed McKenna, it's the psychological equivalent of being skinned alive.
Oh, God.
It's what it feels like a lot of the time for me. I can't speak for anyone else, but if you do feel that way, then it's okay.
Can I ask you, I know for myself I can definitely map waxing and waning periods. There are times, I'll go 3 months where I'm totally fine, and then I'll be totally depressed for months at a time. And I sort of, for me, it comes in waves. Do you find this is a fairly consistent state for you? Or
the being skinned alive, yeah. But yes and no. It's like I said earlier, it's kind of like there's a constant low level feeling of that pressure. And then another good analogy would be the lobster pot, right? The crucible lobster pot, like the thing in Paris happened, which I paid some attention to. I think I tweeted once about it, which of course is risky in today's environment. But I just said something like, the only thing that happened in Paris was that the temperature in the lobster pot went up by several degrees rather than just by a micro degree, so everybody noticed they're in a pot and got upset about that. So that's what it is like for me. There are periods where the temperature in the pot goes up really quickly and I'm aware that I'm in a pot. It's not so much that the heat gets so unbearable, it's both, because I don't have time to adjust, but also I become aware I am in a fucking pot here. Like, there is no way out of this.
Yeah, I see. I didn't comment on these things at all. I didn't even. I have such a hard time. I have two obstacles right now. One is just a purely time in the day to make to actually like to research things, to make any educated opinion on them,
Right.
or a educated statement on them. And the other,
Yeah, I don't get educated first, and I get all kinds of flack for it. Anyway,
well,
sorry, carry on.
I'll be honest. I almost messaged you shortly before we did this interview and said, like, I don't think we should do it because I feel out of touch, like, with the information, right? Like, has my understanding of the world advanced in the last year as I've been mostly unplugged? And one could argue, well, I've had time to process all the tons of information I absorbed when I had more free time, or one could argue that I'm out of touch and I'm not sure which it is. So I was almost like, oh God, I don't want to be put on the spot. I have to make a comment about Paris. I don't even know what fucking happened. I don't know. I know some people got shot, and so it could be a false flag. It could be terror. I don't fucking know what happened. All right. Oh, there's people got killed in California. What happened there? I don't know. It's crazy. I don't know. All I know is like there's crazy shit. But see, I think you just summed it up perfectly, which is all I see is it's to go back to Ike, it's the problem reaction solution. I see a stimulus and a reaction. So if I pop on Facebook for 10 minutes and before I go to bed, and all I see is it's a conspiracy, it's terrorism, it's whatever, and lots of everyone weighing in and reacting to this stimulus, and I'm sort of like, I don't know what they're so excited about. I can't chime in. There's nothing to really add to this, but it's being very outside and observing. I love the way you described it because that is basically it's like, and in one respect, that's why I feel the future is bleak. Is probably because like I pop into the information stream for 10 minutes and it's like, yep, everyone's going fucking crazy arguing over how bad shit is. Well, back to work, you know. And
Well, yeah, everyone's going crazy. We're in liminal times, and it's just getting more liminal. And to bring it back to which we didn't get into yet is the ideology, like people becoming more and more ideologically bound, and the ideologies are becoming more and more polarized. So, because that is what strengthens the ideological position is when it's being opposed, and when you feel that anything that doesn't agree with your ideology is opposing it or even attacking it, that reinforcement, that binary opposition. It's like one of those jumping bean things, the weights that at both ends just make it spin faster and faster. Maybe jumping beans don't spin faster, but anyway, they keep spinning. So that's what I see. And yeah, I will see, if I see something going, I don't get educated about it. I got pulled into a thing about feminism at Rigorous Intuition. It wasn't supposed to be about feminism. It was supposed to be about transgenderism, which I do feel strongly about because I think something really horrific is going on around that. And if we get into that, we get into it. But needless to say, it's really dangerous waters. You can, well, don't even have to tell you. So. But anyway, that was what it was supposed to be about, but then it sort of veered into feminism, and I know nothing about feminism except that we were born, I grew up in a sort of feminist leftist environment, so I absorbed it. I know as much about it as a fish knows about water,
Right.
but I didn't study it any more than the fish studied the water. It just, I just swam in it, not exclusively, of course, but it was part of the water I swam in. So where is this going? So yeah, to me, it's just educating, being educated in the context you're describing it is more about being ideologically programmed, because that is what education is anyway, largely. If you're
Well,
bringing that, yeah.
just to clarify, what I do mean is having at least data points.
I know what you meant, but
But no,
still.
I agree because everyone's collecting different bits of data. So the guy who's watching Fox News, he's collecting data to reinforce his position. The person who's sure everything's a false flag is collecting data. And I don't mean that as a dismissive. I just mean that as everyone is going to their source to get their data points. It's almost everyone's looking for confirmation of the bias rather right. than doing true investigative journalism. And that's what I find lacking, but I also find I'm not necessarily... I'm obviously not the one to do it right now.
Yeah, well, this isn't that kind of conversation, because I'm not... Well, I am doing it, but it's because it's my own family, right? And so I am learning, developing my chops in terms of investigative journalism, just the facts. Just put the facts down and see what they suggest. But as you say, also, that's never unbiased, because we're not putting all the facts down, we're isolating certain facts and putting them together because we think that they will link up to make a picture. I am. And so, of course, there's some ideological basis to it, because I'm not free of ideology. But it's a spectrum, I guess, but there's a big difference between facts that are selected in a slightly prejudiced way, or even a largely prejudiced way, because of ideology, and facts that are actually being used to support an ideology.
Sure. Right? And that's a completely fair statement.
And that's what we're seeing more and more of. Because people are using facts or factoids or whatever as weapons to attack people who don't agree with them, and to bolster up their own identity, which is ideologically dependent. And I don't want to get sucked into even the level that we're discussing now, because it's not personal enough, and it's also not transpersonal enough. Because if we're going to talk about it in a big sense, why not pull all the way back, you know, and talk about Paris or terrorism or whatever it is as a movement of consciousness in the universe, and perhaps a movement towards unification and awareness and who knows what else. But certainly, that would be a spiritual ideology probably. I mean, you couldn't get away from some sort of value system, but I don't know if I made my point there, but just, yeah.
Stars, stars, stars.
if I may, there's something I had wanted to, a direction I was thinking of a few minutes ago, and this maybe is maybe even the individuation versus the collective is a sort of opposing system, right? We have the, like, we all come together as one, or no, I have to individuate and find the source in myself, as you said before. So, like, there's, which I don't think have to be mutually exclusive. I think both are important, but I think, again, we're sort of, I am constantly thinking about the lack of intimacy between humans that I think, when the conversation of pedophilia comes up, this is one thing for me that I've, it brings up for me. It's one sort of emotional sort of and intellectual space that is really charged for me. Is I also feel very alone, very, like, when I'm with just myself, it's a lot of questioning and doubt. I also find true moments of enjoyment and the things that I look forward to is the human connection, but not just, you know, when I'm at work and I'm talking to someone, they said, hey, did you hear Domino's now makes a ranch flavored pizza crust? And I'm like, wow, that's amazing. I didn't know that. And I'm like, what the fuck am, you know, but there's that, you know, that feeds my intellectual elitism of like, you know, I'm so much better than you. I don't even think about these things, you know. And then there's the other part that's like, oh, I can't wait. I'm going to go tomorrow. At least I'll get off work tonight and I'll go home and I'll speak to Horsley and I'll have a real conversation, right? But I think this also speaks to essentially intimacy. What we're doing is a form of fornication, to be blunt, in the sense of like it's the mingling. It's an intimate moment where we're able to share ideas with each other, and I think we're so hungry for it because we've been shown in every way, shape, and form that there's a socially acceptable level of interaction that to me is very surface. It's very, very inane, and you can't go further than that without it being something sexualized. If someone made a joke at my job yesterday. I was working, and I saw this woman, and I said, "Oh, you look familiar." And doesn't really matter, but I just said, "Oh, you look familiar. Have you eaten at this restaurant?" And she said, "Oh, yeah, I ate there once. Oh, I think you were my waiter." And I said, "Yeah, okay, yeah, I thought so. Good to see you again." End of story. And the guy was...
You were her waiter? Or
I was her waiter, right.
Okay.
And she was, you know, so she had eaten at a restaurant. I served her table once. And this was in a different context. And I was just like, "Oh, yeah, okay." And the guy I was working with, he's like, "Oh, you flirting? I'm going to tell your wife." Like, you know, bad joke. And I'm like, no, like, that wasn't flirting. I was just like, I noticed a human being and was trying to make a connection. And even though he was just joking, it sort of speaks to the idea that we have everything in our society becomes instantly sexualized because we don't know any other way. We don't know what the, like, when you and I are talking about, what is the goal? Why do I wake up today? What is the thing? What is the end result? I'm hoping that such and such happens. Well, for most people, and myself and you probably included to varying degrees, we are culturally programmed to think the end result is, of course, some sort of sexual interaction, right. And whether explicitly or not. So I feel like it's made it really difficult. It's why the feminism topic is, are we sexualizing women, but also are we sexualizing children? I mean, as I said, my wife has younger sisters. I was trying to explain this to them now that they're a little bit older, like, why when they were real young, like, you could just play with them and everything's fun, and they reach this sort of certain age where it's almost like, I can't really be friends with you anymore because it's awkward. Like, it's socially awkward if, you know, oh, you want to, you know, give me a big hug. And, you know, like, just like, weird things, like all the weird things that come up around, like, is this inappropriate? Why? Because are you becoming a sexualized creature? Or in other people's eyes, does that become inappropriate? And all these weird boundaries we put on things that what I've noticed over the last number of years is more and more and more I'm find it very hard to deal with human beings, and I show all my affection to animals. Like when I see an animal, like I'll go to someone's house and they have a cute dog, and I just go to the dog, and I'll just, while everyone else, all the adult human beings are interacting, I'm gonna go play with the fucking dog. Why? Because I can outpour all my affection on this thing, and no one's gonna think, oh, Alan wants to fuck that dog. But I can show the affection that I have in my heart and just say, I'm just happy to interact with you, fellow living creature. Whereas if I do that with a human being of any age or gender, our society suddenly starts throwing in weird things that, what does that mean? What is the goal there? What is... And I feel like we're hungry for a platonic, non-sexual intimacy. And it's not, again, it's not a counter to the points of, yes, there is predatory, you know, pedophilia, and that there is debates around feminism. I just feel like this is an aspect of the conversation that doesn't get brought up enough, is that...
Yeah, and I think it, you know, the child abuse, child sexual abuse is an extreme. It may not be extreme in the sense of being rare or unusual, but it's an extreme for most people to think about case of an environment or an experience that creates intense alienation and an inability to be intimate, right? But a... you know, before I'd say before, a little bit congruent with my beginning to realize, suspect, and then realize that there was sexual trauma in my childhood, was the awareness that when I'd been born, because I don't remember these early years, that there had been no one there that I could connect to. Like, my parents were alcoholic, my brother and sister were quite a lot older. I mean, my sister was 7 years, my brother was 4 years older, so there was a big gap there, and they had already been subjected to the kind of damage that the environment that I was being born into, you know, had done to them already in that time. So they were already traumatized, let's say, put it simply. So it was as if I was born into this realm of ghosts, and actually, you know, not just desperate, but needing intimacy in order to survive, not being able to find it. And I don't have a memory of this, but I have a kind of body memory, like it's making me feel quite distressed just trying to describe it, of reaching out and finding nothing to touch, no human warmth. And I mean, not none. I don't want to draw too fine a point on it. And certainly my sister was kind of surrogate mother, which, you know, has its, not necessarily entirely healthy, but it would have helped me survive anyway. And my mother was, you know, she was a smothery mother when she was a happy drunk, and a you know, dragon mother when she was an unhappy drunk. But there wasn't much in between, so I'm not sure if I got hardly any real human warmth from her, because if she was drunk, you know, it wouldn't really have been transmitting, you know, her body wouldn't have been giving that organic connection. Even in the womb, you know, she was drinking. So, I can't remember where I was going to go with that. And then, you know, as an adult, I mean, my father, certainly, he was completely estranged. We were completely estranged, and he couldn't even express affection verbally, never mind physically. But my mother also, she was quite affectionate in some ways, but physically she wouldn't touch us. She almost never touched us, and so I've inherited that. Like, I find it very difficult to touch people. I don't necessarily want to. Like, I have this thing with shaking hands where I just don't really like it most of the time, and I think there's a good reason not to want physical intimacy, because a lot of people don't have enough boundaries in a sense. Like, they're not aware of the stuff that they're carrying around, and but that's almost a separate issue. In terms of my own fear of intimacy and how deep that goes, and I know you're not just talking about physical intimacy, I'm talking about also psychological intimacy and emotional intimacy, and that also, I think that I'm glad that you hit on the zeroed in on that, because it seems to be more meaningful than, more experiential and more relevant. And I think it pertains to the ideological armor, that the more people become ensconced in ideology, in their constructed identity, the less safe it is to express. It's not just about expressing sexuality or intimacy, it's about expressing opinions that are considered unacceptable, right? So even just in terms of speaking one's mind, which is the most surface level of intimate engagement, even that's not safe. So it's as though there's a narrower and narrower space in which we can express ourselves, and if we can't express ourselves, we can't be intimate, of course. Like, there's n whatever we're
Right,
able
true
to
intimacy
express is
comes
so
from like a sort
from
of
deeper parts.
metaphorical nakedness, right? Like that you
Yeah,
would right,
vulnerability, openness.
fully reveal your ideas and sort of
More than your ideas, though,
well,
your fears, your wounds, your sorrows, your longings. I mean, like, you say that you and I are exchanging ideas today, and to some extent we are, but actually less so than last time so far, and certainly exchanging something more than ideas, which is our deep unrest, our deep, our pain and being human and things like this. These aren't ideas, these are realities that we can couch in ideas and try and sort of work on and figure out by putting them in the context of ideas, but really they're not. I think you probably would agree or have the same sense that we can't resolve these internal tensions any more than we can overcome the absence of intimacy by working it out at an idea level.
I don't, it's anything I could add to that would is unnecessary. Yeah, it's exactly. It requires. I wonder. So true intimacy would probably be working on multiple levels. So it would be the idea, the emotion, the and ultimately something physical maybe of you gave the example of a handshake. Like I'm a handshake hug sort of guy, right? So that would be interesting. Like and there's always it's always interesting when you meet somebody how that sort of interaction happens. And like I said, I'm obviously not in a sexual way. Like even like my I think back even to my wife, I remember like, just thinking back to I met her, but we were living in different states. She was living in Virginia, I was living in New York. We met while we were out of town, just sort of like talked and whatever, and then we kept up over the phone and just spoke a lot on the phone, on the phone, on the phone, on the phone, and then visit each other. So the first time she came to visit me in New York, it was sort of like, I had this idea that when she gets off the bus, I'm gonna kiss her, I'm gonna embrace her. And it was like, couldn't really do that because this is our first true interaction, even though we've been intimate in an idea way, in a quasi-romantic way of like sort of wooing each other long distance way, there was still that like hesitation, and I'm expecting she's gonna get off and I'm just gonna grab her and kiss her, and I didn't do it. It was just like, Hey, good to see you. You know, it's like that sort of thing, right? Well, in the same so in the same sort of way, like when I've done. So you did this event where you got to like meet Misty and John, and I'm sure a few other people that you've met over the course of you know, your years of being an alternative research figure. I don't know how many people you've met in real life, you know, in the flesh, but doing I made it a sort of a goal to try and meet as many people as possible in real life, because I feel like there's so much more conveyed in a real, even this, I don't know if you're feeling this, like having the cameras on is a very different, right? Like there's like an eye contact essentially. And when you're doing that in real life, there's this whole other level that comes to it. Like my friend Will Morgan, so I can call a friend at this point, he said like when he met me, he didn't realize how much I got, so I got to talk with my hands and how much more sort of context he got, where if I might be making a sarcastic comment or something that didn't come through in the audio podcast. But which comes through in my body language or whatever, or and all the sort of things that come through. And anyway, so like I found in meeting people that I've corresponded with or talked with on Facebook and all this sort of stuff. So like we did this event in Olympia last year, and you know, like you see somebody and you're like, oh shit, you're this guy, you know, like what's, you know, and I'm the kind of guy I go and just grab and give him a big hug. I'm like, hey, so nice to meet you. And like, it's like, I'm assuming we know each other. We're on that personal level. And then you sort of see in certain people, it's like, that's really weird to them, you know? And it's the, and that has, not only does that has multiple ripples because, in one respect, I can laugh about it, and they can say, "Well, that guy's, you know, as you're saying, well, that guy doesn't understand good boundaries." But then also, it the other effect it has on me is in the conversation I'm saying, sort of like where I'm coming from of like confused sexuality, like the hunger for platonic intimacy being confused with sexuality is sort of it forces me to almost retreat a little bit back inside myself, where it's like, oh, I've overstepped, and I sort of find myself pulling back even more. And that's what I'm saying, like more and more I find myself, my wife says this to me all the time. She says, you know, you used to be, we could go to a party or a something and you could have a conversation with anybody, and now I can't do it. And I was like, there were times where I was like, well, maybe it's like a intellectual elitism thing where I'm like, I just don't want to have the inane conversation anymore. We went to a wedding and some guy, you know, was like, so what do you do for a living? So, and I'm like, come on, man, I don't have this conversation. I went to a wedding where I was just like, look, I don't want to do this. Can we not do this? You know, like, really? We have to do this? Can you just, you eat your food, I'll eat my food, we'll both go home and have a fucking nice life. Just sort of
That's
sitting,
what you said,
yeah,
yeah.
like, just we're sitting next to each other doesn't mean we have to do this. You know, like, so in one respect, it's like, I just don't want to have the inane conversation. And on the other hand, it's also, again, the learned sort of retreat back inside yourself. Don't make new connections. Don't, you know,
Well, there's an in-between though, those two things, aren't there?
totally.
There's an in-between, I can't think of the word, it's not quite complicity, but complying with, going along with the inane social thrust to engage at that level and blocking it completely, which is the in-between, is simply staying open and giving your attention to that person but not giving them anything back. So that's the literal equivalent is with a handshake. Like if I meet somebody, you know, they're standing in front of me, them sticking their hand out, even though the symbolic thing is an open palm, and so it does symbolize I trust you, I'm making myself vulnerable to you. I get that. But it doesn't actually mean that. Just because it symbolizes it doesn't mean it means it, right? Just as someone would say, I love you, and it doesn't mean a damn thing. And in fact, probably more times than not, it's the opposite. It's actually a shield. The handout is a shield. So whereas I could just be standing there like an autist, you know, playing the autistic and with my hands flapping at my sides or whatever, like, I don't know how to do handshakes, sorry, and without saying it, but I could be really open to that person. Like I could actually be exuding interest and engagement, and they might not even notice. Then all they would notice is that I didn't take their hand. So, it's not, I suppose, in part of the same thing I'm describing here, is that it's case specific. Like when I went to Vancouver, I actually decided, okay, I'm not going to shake people's hands before the thing, because I don't want to risk getting all, you know, tangled up with people's threads and losing my center, and that will affect the whole thing. And so I'll just make a clear boundary. And I did, and it felt a little bit weird, but it wasn't a big deal. But then after the thing, there was hugs and all the rest of it. And but it was, I did that because I didn't feel confident enough to really be able to gauge in each case. And also, if you shake some people's hands and not others, then yeah, then it gets personal, right?
So right. Why do you feel so comfortable with that guy or that girl, but that's not me, right?
So it's really, I mean, that's a good microcosm of the social context. It makes it so difficult just to be spontaneous and true to what you're feeling in that moment or what you're experiencing in that moment. Do I shake the hand or I don't? Do I extend the hand or not? Because, you know, sometimes if you approach a person in the right way, like this guy at the wedding, it might have been possible for you to change the subject or change the direction of the conversation simply by listening in such a way that he himself felt, I don't want to talk about this stuff.
It's a long story which I already discussed on my own podcast, so I don't want to rehash, but I did actually attempt an alternative conversation, which didn't particularly go very well. And again, it was a very immature outburst on my part. I'm not saying. I was just giving that as the example of, like, that's, in a lot of ways, this is what I'm thinking. And this was a rare case where I expressed it outwardly, where right. I'm usually at social functions going, like, with all this internal mind chatter. And in this particular case, I was just, like, fully out. This was just after the church shooting in Charleston, South Carolina. My wife's friend was getting married in Charleston, South Carolina. So within like a few weeks, I'm going down there. I'm, again, as a New Yorker, being even in like North Carolina and Virginia level of the South has been a little bit of a culture shock for me. But being in Charleston was very much a culture shock for me, as far as like a very out and open on surface level sort of self-segregating and caste system, black and white, was like really out in the open.
What was that word you used?
Self-segregating or caste system.
Oh, caste system, right.
Like, it was, I've just honestly never experienced anything like it. So I'm here, it's historically, culturally significant, as it's on the news of, you know, church shooting, white guy who's worried about white genocide. Red Ice is located in Charleston, South Carolina now. Like all the sort of weird internal chatter that's going on of like the personal significance for me. And then the wedding is at a fucking plantation. Someone rented out like this, oh, it's so beautiful, right? But like as you park in the parking lot, and then this golf cart takes you from the parking lot into the main grounds. And as we're going down the path, some old rich white lady on the golf cart says, "Are those over there? Are those the slave quarters?" You know, and the driver's like, "Yep, those were." You know, like, and it's like it was like Disneyland. You know, And over here on your right, here's where people were raped and murdered and, you know, forced into slavery. And I'm like, so we're at this fucking thing, and the guy just starts this conversation, and I was just like, you want to fucking talk to me? Talk to me about what the fuck are we doing sitting in a fucking plantation right now, not acknowledging that we're trying to have a happy moment in a place of fucking sadness and torture. Like, I feel like we're like, it's like, let's do the jitterbug at the fucking Auschwitz. I was like, what the fuck are we doing here, you know? It just felt so dissociated from reality, of like, of the history of the moment. It just felt so, I think just it all bubbled, that burst out of me. So
well, that's like a microcosm of you know, the social existence, isn't it? You know, the context in which we're trying to celebrate and have a great time and affirm how wonderful our way of life is. What's the context? Don't talk about that.
Cops are rolling and the peaches are rotten. The oranges are packed in their creosote drums. It's Ryan is back to the Mexican border to spend all our money and we back again.
Yeah, it was at that point that Al and I took a 2-minute break to de and rehydrate, and after the break we got into some very interesting and murky waters around sex work and sexuality and our own personal experiences with it, and you can hear the rest of our conversation this coming Wednesday, the 16th of December 2015. Just to say that I'm very active currently at Rigorous Intuition Forum, involved once again after a long break with the KubraCon investigation. There's a thread there devoted to that, and also discussing the very complex and thorny subject of sexual identity, gender, feminist ideology and stuff like that. So anyone wants to engage with those subjects, then Rigorous Intuition is where you can do that, more than my own forum, sorry to say. No donations this week to thank, maybe next week. If you do want to donate, you can go to horticulture.com/limitless, or in fact any page of the website, or also at my blog, horticulture.wordpress.com. I have a terrible mouth sore right now. Unfortunately, I've recorded a podcast after this one. That will be with James Kunstler. And hopefully my mouth will recover in the meantime, in time for the one after that. Thanks for listening. This is Jason Horsley, slurring his words, and The Liminalist, the podcast between.
Deportees.